Thank you. Be seated. We wish to express our appreciation to the Third Court of Appeals for allowing us to use their court. We're Ben Sons from Hidalgo County. General Electric versus Falcon Ridge Apartments from Harris County. And Charlotte Washington McLaren and others, versus Ann Beard and others from Travis County. We will take a brief recess in between each of these arguments, but we will complete all three arguments before our lunch break. Justice Gamage will be here in due time and will participate in the deliberation in all three of these causes. The court is now ready to hear oral argument from Petitioner Ika and Sons.
May it please this honorable court, as was announced, my name is Robert McLeish. I'm here representing the petitioner, Tubalite, a division of Indahl Incorporated, hereinafter referred to by me as Tubalite, in its cause of action against the respondent, Risica and Sons Incorporated. Hereinafter, I will refer to them as Risica. Briefly, this cause was filed in the 275th District Court by the law offices of Katie Klein to collect on a sworn account. Upon receipt of service of citation, Risica promptly countersued, alleging usury. Tubalite amended pleadings, defended, alleging implied contract. This was right up front, if it pleases the court. 8 days before trial, I appeared as counsel for Tubalite. Most of the facts at the trial were undisputed or virtually undisputed. The dispute lies in the application of the law in this case. Risica was a subcontractor on a construction project for the First State Bank and Trust Company of Edinburgh, Texas. I believe sometime subsequent to the transactions involved, the bank failed, and I think the evidence will show that Risica never got paid by the bank or the FDIC or anyone else, as I understood it. However, at the commencement of the contract, Risica needed certain components fabricated. Risica called for bids. Tubalite responded, submitted a bid, and the Tubalite bid was ultimately accepted. It should be noted the Tubalite bid neither mentioned credit terms, and it did not, nor did it extend credit. It was simply a price bid, nothing more. Certain testimony at trial was undisputed. Certainly there was no dispute, both parties were corporations. Both parties were merchants of the particular products which are the subject of this litigation. And due to the nature of Risica's contract, the merchandise was fabricated and shipped in stages or components.
Counsel, since neither the bid nor the acceptance called for interest at a rate of 1.5% per month. I didn't mention interest. Is it your position that this case is not controlled by Section 2.207 of the Texas version of the Uniform Commercial
Code? It's my position that it is controlled by Section 2.207.
Even though the bid and the acceptance were silent on the issue of interest?
What I would like to point out, Mr. Justice Cornyn, is that as each component was ordered by Risica, the Tubalite would send an acknowledgement. The acknowledgement stated on its face, among other things, acceptance hereof is limited to the terms and conditions appearing on the front and reverse side hereof. That's an exact quote, Your Honor. Paragraph 4 on the reverse side of the acknowledgement reads in part, past due invoices will be subject to a service charge of 1.5% per month at an annual rate of 18%. Further, it came out at the time of trial that each of the acknowledgements had this information.
The trial judge did not make a conclusion of law that this case was governed by Section 2.207, did he? He merely found that there was an implied contract.
That is correct, Your Honor. I don't believe that the trial judge mentioned 2.207.
Did you mention it to him?
We mentioned the Biozyme case, basically, and all that it stood for, and that would include, Mr. Justice Heck, would include 2.207, since it is referred to rather extensively in the Biozyme case. And yes, Your Honor, that was mentioned.
Both of the parties in this case were clearly merchants, and there's no doubt
I don't think
that.
There was any question of it. Mr. Justice Cook, I had an opportunity to examine Mr. Risica, and he acknowledged on the stand that not only were they merchants in this sort of case, but they were some of the leading glass merchants, glass contractors in the valley. And I believe that they are.
Yet your client did not charge or did not send a bill for the interest charges for more than a year.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And can you explain that and how the parties could have agreed to it and yet your client not actually billed for it for more than a year?
I could explain it this way. Each time an order was received and before a shipment was made, an acknowledgement was sent which had this information. It said, subject to a service charge of. Testimony at time of trial of my client's representative, Bill McDaniels, went this way. Bill McDaniels stated that he had done something about throwing into the computer a code 9, whatever code 9 did, which kept the service charge from going out, stating that initially he was sympathetic to Risica. Namely, he understood the problem Risica had. Risica was having a severe financial problem.
They weren't getting paid either.
They were not getting paid. My client recognized that, you know, it's very hard for them to pay if they weren't getting paid, and it would become even harder if they kicked the interest in. So for a long time, they did forbear. But they did constantly place notice. They never, never received an objection. As was pointed out, each of those was mailed right after the goods were ordered and before they were shipped. Next, the goods were shipped and invoiced. And the invoice they had passed due in. The invoices referred back to the acknowledgement and stated past due invoices will be subject to a service charge. Then at the end of each month, there was additional mention made of service charges, but this, of course, would be after the merchandise was shipped. And this procedure was repeated each time a shipment was made. I'm thinking that there were somewhere between 5 and 6 separate shipments, and so 5 and 6 separate times this procedure was followed.
Did you ever receive any protest to the language that was contained on the back of your invoices, that language?
Mr. Justice Cook, we did not. Never. Never received a protest, either verbally or in writing. That was the undisputed testimony at time of trial. Mr. Risica acknowledged that he had never protested, either verbally or in writing.
Did he acknowledge that he knew what was on the back of the form?
He did not acknowledge one way or the other, Your Honor. He simply said, I didn't agree to it. But as far as having acknowledged that he took the trouble to read it, I don't know whether he took the trouble to read it or not, but I think the code would definitely give him, would place on him as a merchant a duty to so read. It's argumentative, and I admit it is. But,
did y'all have occasion to look at the forms which they used?
Yes, Your Honor, we did.
Did they contain similar language?
Are we talking about the forms that Tubalite used?
Yes.
We did indeed. They were introduced in at time of trial. And this evidence was testified to at time of trial from the documents themselves. The documents were fairly standard for Tubalite. They constantly use them. These people deal in interstate commerce and I think have attempted at least to comply with the Uniform Commercial Code, which is basically the same as the Business and Commerce Code of Texas.
Did Risica ever pay any of the interest charged by your client? The record indicates there was a $10,000 payment made on principal, but no, I was unable to find any reference to payment of the interest that was charged.
I think the record will show that Tubalite never charged interest until April 30th of 1986.
Until they begin to wonder whether they'd be paid?
And that's correct. Well, at this time, Mr. McDaniel indicated a loss of sympathy with Risiga. He was not seeing sufficient evidence, apparently, of an effort being made. Subsequent to this charging of interest, Risiga did make some payments. They made five payments, as I recall, of $2,000 each. They weren't necessarily in monthly sequence, but they did make some payments.
Were they credited to principal or to interest or to both?
They were credited to principal, and that was a decision once again made by Mr. McDaniel. I think in an effort to help Risiga.
That in order to their benefit?
To Risiga's benefit?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. It would certainly have inured to the benefit of Risiga. And I think he meant that it do so. And once again, at the time that Risiga did make the payments, the $2,000 payments totaling $10,000, they did not object to the fact that interest had been charged. They simply sent $2,000 in. I could not see from the record that they made any effort to control whether the $2,000 went to interest or principal or both. The decision to credit principal was the decision of Bill McDaniels, the credit manager of Tubalite, not a request on the part of Risiga. At the conclusion of the trial,
was the section 2.207 argued in the Court of Appeals?
It was mentioned at the Court of Appeals. Basically, it was argued primarily through the argument concerning Biozyme. It was our position that in the Biozyme case, and I'm referring to Preston Farm and Ranch versus Biozyme, which I was planning to get to a little later on, but this case was argued extensively, and the component parts of this case were argued. And one cannot read the Biozyme case and not come up to Section 2.207 because it's a major function of it.
Well, that case says that 2.207 doesn't apply under these circumstances, does it, because you're dealing with a modification of the terms of the
I don't believe it does, Mr. Justice Cornyn. I think it does state that it applies.
Can you explain why you think that?
Yes, Your Honor. Could I just quote from the case itself? If we were to go to pages 299 and 300, the court in the Biozyme case, and by the way, let me give the site. That's 625 Southwestern 2nd, 295, and I'm quoting from 299 and 300. We hold that the process of acceptance and confirmation to which Section 2207 is addressed stops short of a monthly statement sent after the goods have been shipped. After the goods have been shipped. But Tubalite went further than that. Tubalite, on each individual component that was shipped, sent out an acknowledgement. On the acknowledgement, Tubalite showed not only the merchandise that was being shipped, but Tubalite also made reference to the credit terms, namely, and this was before a shipment ever went out, the credit terms were that past due payments were subject to a service charge, and that service charge was spelled out at 1.5% per month. I don't think they left any doubt. I think the people in Tubalite, aside from having been more compassionate than just about any credit managers I've ever run into, were very diligent about giving prior notice before they ever shipped any goods. And I believe that that is not at variance with the statement in Biozyme or the reference to 2.207. In fact, if I might refer your honors to 2.207, since it is such a powerful component of the Biozyme case, I'm reading subsection B. The additional terms are to be construed as proposals for addition to the contract. Between such merchants, such terms become part of the contract unless, and then subsection 3, notification of objection to them has already been given or is given within a reasonable time after notice of them is received. In this case, we never charged interest for over a year, so I think that was more than reasonable time for an objection, argumentatively.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. If the parties had, there had been a bid and an acceptance without any reference to interest, and your client had not charged any interest in the acknowledgement statement until, say, a year after shipments began, but with after a year they sent an acknowledgement citing a requirement that interest be paid off past due accounts, and thereafter the contractor accepted the shipment, would that form an implied contract or one under 2.207 that interest would be charged?
I think that would be a more difficult case, Your Honor. I see my time is up. I had wanted to discuss Note 5 and Note 6. I will simply refer, Your Honors, to Notes 5 and 6.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from Rasika.
May it please the Court, Mr. Sidney Meadows and Mr. Frank Marikas present arguments to the respondent. Mr. Meadows, please.
May it please the Court, Mr. McLeish. My name is Sidney Meadows of the law firm of Freeland & Meadows, and I, along with Honorable Frank Henriquez of the law firm of Henriquez & Gonzalez, represent Rissica & Sons, Inc., respondent herein. Although Mr. Henriquez and I have divided our time essentially such that Mr. Henriquez will discuss the aspect of the duty of a merchant to object to a unilateral alteration subsequent to the initial contract, and I will discuss essentially the first point of error dealing with charging of usury, there will naturally be an overlap of the cases cited and of the facts discussed.
Is it your view that this case is controlled by the rule pertaining to contracts implied in fact by a course of conduct, or is this case controlled by Article 2.207 of the Uniform Commercial Code, or by both?
Your Honor, our position is that the Triton case, which is the Triton Oil and Gas versus Marine Contractors, is exactly on point. That case is a course of conduct, and it sets forth that certain facts cannot, as a matter of law, justify a finding of course of conduct. Our position is that the course of conduct theory of law governs this case. Although we do acknowledge, as Mr. McLeish has pointed out, that in the present case, Article 2.207 is discussed, we feel that that is distinguished in the fact of this case. This case deals with a contract for specially manufactured goods, and because of the fact that respondent Rissica & Sons, Inc. required these goods, which required 28 weeks of lead time to manufacture, the parties entered into an express written contract with detailed terms detailing the manufacturing specification and the price. The terms of this agreement are fully set forth in the quotation submitted by petitioner Tube Life, which was admitted into evidence as Defendant's Exhibit Number 6. There were no materials shipped that were not contained in the quotation by Tube Life, and there were no subsequent purchase orders placed by respondent Rissica after there were no purchase orders placed after the March 25, 1985 acceptance. The final shipment of goods called for in a contract were shipped, I believe, somewhere around October. But up until that time, up until the final shipment of goods, the petitioner did not charge any interest to Rissica, and Rissica did not pay any interest to Tube Life. It was only after the final shipment of goods had been delivered, and I believe it was a few months later, when the petitioner was endeavoring to use leverage as an effort to, we feel, limited to the purpose of coercion of collection, that petitioner unilaterally began to charge interest at the rate of 1.5% per month. It is our position that the acknowledgments were delivered after the contract had been fully executed. The terms of the contract were fully agreed to prior to the delivery by Tube Life of any of the acknowledgments, which contained on the back the reference to the right to charge 1.5% interest. During the course of the contract, would like to point out to this court that that petitioner was sending out statements of fact, which, according to the testimony of their credit manager, Mr. McDaniel, were contradictory on their face. On the top right-hand corner, they said past due accounts will be charged in interest at the rate of 1.5% per month. In the body of the statement of account, they had the principal due with no interest. This was these type of statements, which on their face did not charge interest, were received by RISICA, and RISICA was acting on these invoices, these statements of account, during the course of the contract.
Those statements of account were not past due, though, at the time they were received, were they?
The evidence does not indicate when the account became past due, Your Honor. There were, Justice Hightower, there were some partial payments that were made on the performance. As RISICA worked on the First State Bank and Trust building and was made partial performance payments, they in turn paid the tube light. There's no indication in the record, to the best of my knowledge, as to when the account became more than 30 days past due.
You would hardly want to penalize the supplier for forbearing interest. If he chose not to charge any for whatever reason, magnanimity,
petitioner suggests, so why shouldn't he be able to do that?
Mr. Justice Heck, we addressed this issue by simply pointing out to the court that there was no agreement to charge interest. The petitioner, Tube Light, had no right to charge interest. This was not, in our opinion, a forbearance of their right. This was simply that after a sufficient amount of time had passed, they were looking for alternative sources of leverage and elected to use the interest as leverage. We feel that the facts of this case established conclusively that there was no agreement to pay interest and that the rate of interest was mandated by Article 5069-1.03 to be limited to no more than 6%.
Why didn't the acknowledgement sent by Tube Light after the contract was formed, you say, effectuate the interest element of the agreement under Comment 1 to Section 2.207?
Your Honor, I would have to confess I'm not familiar with Comment 1, but I would.
It says that after an agreement has been reached, then if the parties continue to send memoranda embodying the terms to one another, then those memoranda may become part of the agreement under Section 2.207.
Your Honor, first of all, it is our position that 2.207 does not apply because of the nature of the contract. There was no agreement by RISICA at any time to pay any interest. The testimony from Mr. RISICA is that the RISICA & Sons, Inc. never agreed to pay interest and never did pay interest. The testimony by Mr. McDaniel is that they never received interest and never applied any payments to interest. Our position is that these statements that were contained in the acknowledgement were merely printed form statements that were in the standard form that Tube Light used, whereby they might have negotiated interest ahead of time. Since we are dealing with a completed contract and there is no evidence of any agreement to these modifications, we feel that Article 2.207 does not control this issue.
What was the agreement to pay? Payment upon receipt of invoice?
Your Honor, I believe, Mr. Justice Hightower, I believe that the agreement was to pay within 30 days. There is no testimony in the record as to the terms of payment, but I believe that perhaps under the original price quotation, I would respectfully request to look at that, but I believe that the agreement was they would pay within 30 days of the date of shipment, Your Honor.
Counsel, the trial court found as a matter of, as a conclusion of law, matter of fact, that an implied contract was reached between the parties. So, you're here saying there was no evidence.
That's to correct.
That finding of fact, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that there was no evidence to support that finding of fact or that conclusion of law. And once again, we feel like the case of the Triton case is on point. The evidence is absolute that there was no direct agreement. there absolutely was no written or verbal assention to pay interest. The court found this finding of fact. I would not begin to speculate why, but would point out that Triton, in almost similar fact situations, this honorable Supreme Court held that those facts conclusively established the absence of an agreement.
That was not a case decided under the Uniform Commercial Code, was it?
No, Your Honor. I believe that in Triton, this dealt with a similar situation. In both RISCA and Triton, there were written contracts. Our position is that the quotation that was submitted by Petitioner Tubelite, together with the acceptance submitted by Respondent RISCA, constituted the written contract, similar to the contract that was present in the Triton.
Your position is that there cannot ever be any subsequent modification of the accepted bid. Is that correct?
Excuse me, Your Honor. That is not our position. We recognize the authority in this state of the case of Preston versus Biozyme. That dealt with significantly different fact situations. This was an open account case where goods were being shipped pretty much continuously. I believe there were in excess of 20 separate sales. I believe that they may have even actually made some payments on interest. So we acknowledge that there can be modifications, but we feel like there needs to be a more distinct showing of fact other than a unilateral charging of interest.
So you would agree with the statement made in the Preston Farm, the Biozyme case, as it's been called here, that the question of whether an agreement was reached by the parties is generally a question of fact where the existence of the agreement is disputed.
Yes, Your Honor, we would agree that it is a question of fact, and once again, we would stand on our position that these facts do not evidence any such agreement. Your Honor, at this time, I would, with the court's permission, allow Mr. Enriquez to present his argument.
Head plea to court, Mr. McLeish. My name is Frank Enriquez. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Enriquez and Gonzalez in McAllen, and together with Mr. Meadows, we represent RISCA. I'll be responding to petitioner's fifth point of error, which deals with the concepts of series of transactions and course of conduct. Tubelite here seeks to characterize this purchase agreement as a series of transactions. And the reason why is because then it can go ahead and rely on the Perryman and the Preston cases that have been discussed so far. Those cases hold that when you have a series of transactions, a course of conduct, in other words, a prior track record, then you can have a situation where an interest term is in fact implied into the contract.
How many separate shipments were made?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How many separate shipments were made pursuant to purchase orders by your client?
In this case, Your Honor, there were a number of shipments over time. They extended from, the contract was entered into no later than March of 1985. And the documents that we reviewed indicated that the balance no longer changed in September of 1985. So we're looking at a number of shipments over, a 6-month period.
Five or ten.
I would think something in that range, Your Honor.
And with each, before each shipment was made, RISCA sent one of these acknowledgments which recited a charge of interest for a past due account.
Tubelite claims to have sent an acknowledgement, Your Honor, to RISCA. It's disputed as, yes, sir, Mr. RISCA testified that the acknowledgement came subsequent to the shipment. We feel that it was at about the same time that the shipment occurred that this acknowledgement form came. And the purpose of the acknowledgement form was to document what was shipped, to reflect what was with the shipment, and not to initiate a new contract or to fulfill a new transaction, but rather just more or less like a bill of lading, and it was accepted as such. The Preston case that's been discussed is a 1981 Supreme Court of Texas case. It was an open account. There had been 20 separate prior sales. Service charges in that case had been imposed and had been in fact paid. and the debtor had admitted in that case and had agreed to the service charges in that case. Perryman is a 1983 San Antonio Court of Appeals case. It too involved an open account, and there had been in that situation literally thousands of separate invoices, separate sales extending over an 8 to 10 year period.
How many do there need to be before a course of conduct is established?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at with those cases, Your Honor, is that those were open accounts and the court had before it numerous prior transactions, numerous separate sales. In the Risica Tubelite case, we had a single transaction, an offer, an acceptance at a discrete point in time. That contract was entered into no later than March 1985.
And it could never be modified by subsequent conduct of the parties or written acknowledgments charging interest? Is that your position?
No, sir. Justice Corn, as an attorney, I hate to say never. And certainly I'm not taking that position here. Contracts can be modified in Texas under many commercial theories. And we're certainly not taking the position that it couldn't be subsequently modified. But again, we have a situation here where Tubelite has sought to rely on cases where it's a prior course of conduct, prior separate sales, and that's not really applicable to our situation. What we're talking about is a contract entered into at a discrete point in time with no interest term, and then subsequent deliveries under that contract. It was not an open account. In our situation, you had a single contract. You had a fixed number of materials that were to be delivered at a fixed price for use in construction of a single specific bank building. The contract consisted of the written bid and the acceptance by Risica. Neither contained an interest term, and there were no series of transactions, and there was no prior course of conduct from which an interest term could be implied to this contract. So Perryman and Preston simply do not apply to this case. Tubelite recognizes that the original documents, the original contract documents, the offer and acceptance, do not include an interest term, so they try to supply it by referring to a document that they call an acknowledgement. It does contain an interest term, but the record reflects that this acknowledgement document was not sent until months after the contract was entered into. Its purpose, the testimony showed, was to accompany the shipments, as I indicated before, to reflect what had been shipped and not to initiate a new transaction or to fulfill a new contract. To overcome this problem, Tubelite now argues that Risica and Tubelite being merchants, that Risica had a duty to object to this so-called acknowledgement form. That this acknowledgement form somehow became part of the original contract documents, but it's not. It is an attempt to unilaterally alter the original contract documents by supplying the missing interest provision. The Preston case had a detailed discussion of this concept and clearly indicated, I believe, to the court that the Battle of Forms provision, section 2.207, that has been discussed, does not apply in this situation. It applies only to contract formation. In other words, you start looking at 2207 when you have an acceptance that varies from the offer. Or where you have an oral offer, an oral acceptance, and then the parties seek to formally document it in a writing. Then 2207 comes into play to determine what the original contract documents are and what the contract is. It's
but
not
comment
intended.
Comment 1 says this section is intended to deal with two typical situations. The one is the written confirmation where an agreement has been reached either orally or by informal correspondence between the parties and is followed by one or more of the parties sending formal memoranda embodying the terms so far as agreed upon and adding terms not discussed. Why does that not indicate that section 2.207 does apply to this situation?
Well, it indicates that it applies to the original contract formation. It doesn't indicate, Your Honor, that it applies once you have the contract and then later on you seek to modify it. What we're saying is that a contract was entered into no later than March of 1985. They had an offer, they had an acceptance. They had a price, they had specific number of material that was to be delivered, and that was the contract. If there's going to be a modification, it's got to be under different principles than 2207, because 2207 simply applies to the formation of the contract. It doesn't apply to the subsequent modification. There are other commercial principles that apply, but those principles weren't argued in this case and aren't before this court, and they're not before this court, and they weren't argued because really they don't apply. They don't apply either.
The contract implied in fact was argued and was found by the trial judge. It was on that basis that the trial judge found adversity to your client.
That's correct, Your Honor. A contract implied in fact, but we of course disagree with that because we think we have a contract as a matter of fact. We have an offer and acceptance, and that is the contract, and nothing else can be implied to that.
But you concede that subsequent conduct can modify the terms of that original contract.
Certainly
don't
I do.
You just say there's no evidence here.
That's correct.
And we'd have to look at the record to see whether there was, in fact, any evidence or not.
Okay. I see that my time's up, and so if there's any questions, thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court and my very worthy adversaries, Mr. Enriquez and Mr. Meadows, I would respectfully take issue with one or two things that were said. Mr. Meadows states there was an agreement to pay within 30 days. Your Honors, there is nothing in that record that even implies that there was an agreement to pay at any particular time. And therefore, this was the very sort of contract that is subject to modification under Section 2.207.
If there's never any agreement to pay at a particular time, then what does the law assume when it would be payable?
I don't know that the law makes an assumption, Mr. Justice Hightower. We attempted, and I think we succeeded, in pointing out how it would be paid by sending in our acknowledgments. And by the way, the testimony on page 16 of the transcript of testimony clearly points out that this is in the record, that the acknowledgement was made upon receipt of the order. I don't believe anyone contradicted Mr. McDaniel's testimony on that point. And consistently and constantly, these acknowledgements went out. Admittedly, he held back on the charging of interest, and he pointed out what he did. He threw a Code 9 in at some point to stop interest from being charged because he recognized the problems that Resica faced. I do not believe that this would nullify a contract otherwise created, particularly under the provisions of Business and Commerce Code Section 2207. Mr. Justice Cornyn questioned extensively concerning the meaning of 2.207. I think his questioning was very much in point, and definitely it is this sort of situation. This refers to additional terms, an acceptance or confirmation of a contract, and this is an additional term. It was never objected to. I think Tubalite at all times conducted itself with great forbearance and great decency. I don't think that this should be the sort of thing that would subject a supplier to the rather onerous provisions of the usury statutes of the state of Texas. Quite to the contrary, I think the usury statutes were designed to stop rapacious conduct on the part of suppliers and lenders. I would also like just briefly to refer, if I could, to Note 5 on 2.207. Examples of clauses which involve no element of unreasonable surprise and which therefore are to be incorporated in the contract unless notice of objection is seasonably given are a clause providing for interest on overdue invoices or fixing the seller's standard credit terms where they are within the range of trade practice and do not limit any credit bargained for. I believe that's fairly clear. Likewise, under Note 6, if no answer is received within a reasonable time after additional terms are proposed, it is both fair and commercially sound to assume that this inclusion has been assented to. This is merchant dealing with merchant. The Triton oil case has nothing whatsoever to do with merchant dealing with merchant. This was an oil field operation. It was a well drilling contract, and there was a dispute among the parties, and The notice had not been given, as it was in this case. Quite the contrary, there was a unilateral deduction of interest from payments made by the oil company. With these matters before the court, I would respectfully urge that this honorable court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals, affirm the decision of the trial court, which was a proper and correct decision under the law, render judgment for Tubalite as was originally found by the trial court. Thank your honors very much for this opportunity.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will take a brief recess.
Audience, please rise.